This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on writersvoice.net. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we spend the hour with James Forman Jr. We talk about his groundbreaking book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. My guest James Forman Jr.'s book, Locking Up Our Own, is a close look at a major influence on the development of mass incarceration in America, one that until now has gone largely unnoticed, the role that African American leaders played in the growth of mass incarceration. It's a case of unforeseen consequences arising out of the best of intentions. At the time the book opens, a heroin epidemic was devastating black communities. Civil rights leaders, religious leaders, and politicians emerging from under the repression of Jim Crow feared that the gains they'd made were being eroded by crime and addiction. They looked to the criminal justice system to protect black communities under siege. Decades later, we all know how that's turned out. From 1980 to 2017, the number of people incarcerated in America quadrupled from roughly 500,000 to more than 2.3 million, overwhelmingly black and Latino. Locking Up Our Own is a gripping exploration of how that happened. James Forman Jr. was a public defender in Washington, D.C. for 6 years. He's a professor at Yale Law School and the co-founder of the Maya Angelou Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. It's a school for students who have been court-involved or have dropped out of traditional schools. Well, James Forman Jr., welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This was just a really fascinating read, Locking Up Our Own. The book was very much inspired by your work as a public defender in Washington, D.C. Now, you know, you could have written your own ticket to prominence, given your family history. Your father was a great civil rights leader, James Forman. But instead of going on to some fancy Wall Street firm or high government office, you decided to become a public offender. Why was that?
I can't even really say that it was a difficult decision. I mean, when you say I could have done some of these other things, I guess that's true, but I wasn't tempted by them in any way. I have always been raised to believe that you're going to be working a lot and you need to love what you're doing. That's the most important thing. And you need to be making a social contribution through your work. And both my mother and father, you know, who met in the civil rights movement, they met in SNCC in the 1960s. They were an interracial couple at a time when that was still illegal in many states. And, you know, my mom dropped out of college to join the movement, and my dad gave up his life as well, that he had had as a teacher in Chicago to join the movement. And so I guess we were raised as, you know, it wasn't complicated. It was just what you did. You know, what you did was you fought to try to make the world more fair, more just. And in particular, you fought for racial justice and for civil rights. So that was the background. And then for me, that turned into wanting to work in the criminal justice system because, you know, in the early 1990s, when I graduated from law school and was working as a law clerk, that was really the first time that the reports were starting to come out documenting a phenomenon that's now come to be called mass incarceration, but we didn't have that term at the time. But the Sentencing Project, an advocacy group in D.C., had already reported that first they reported 1 in 4 young black men was under criminal justice supervision, and then they issued a new report just as I was graduating law school and finishing clerking, that it was 1 in 3 young black men. So these numbers were becoming known, and although it hadn't become a national movement yet the way that it has now, there were a number of us that were starting to say, you know, if we're going to continue the civil rights struggle, if we're going to try to find the issue that is most damaging to the health of black communities, this criminal justice system is the place to do it.
You start out this book, Locking Up Our Own, with a story of a young man named Brandon. who you were defending, who came before the D.C. Juvenile Court. Tell us what was going on as he faced the judge in that courtroom.
So Brandon, as a teenager, 16 years old, and he had pled guilty to possession of a gun, a handgun, and possession of about $20 worth of marijuana. And he was facing sentencing, or in juvenile court, they call it disposition, but it's that moment where the judge decides what is going to happen to you. And I was asking for him to be put on probation. I was pointing out the fact that it was his first arrest. I had a letter from his football coach, a letter from one of his teachers attesting to his character. And I had his mom and his grandmother, who were there in court, had been there in court, you know, standing with him and by him every step of the way. And Brandon, as was true of 95% of my clients, was African-American. And the prosecutor in the case, she was also African-American, and she was asking that he be locked up. She wanted him to go to Oak Hill, which is the juvenile detention facility in D.C. That's the polite name. You know, the real name is that it was a dungeon. It was a place where kids just got thrown away. There was a school in theory, but it didn't educate anybody. Drugs and violence were rampant. And the judge that had to make the decision, Judge Curtis Walker, I changed the name in the book of some of the key kind of characters, my clients, to protect their privacy, and the lawyers and judges in the juvenile court proceedings. And Judge Walker sort of leaned back and he looked into Brandon and he said, "Son, Mr. Foreman's been telling me that you've had a tough life and that you deserve a second chance. Well, let me tell you about tough." And then the judge starts to talk about Jim Crow, that era, and what it meant to be living under enforced segregation. And so as he wound up his speech, he said, "So here's the thing, Brandon. People marched and fought and died for your freedom. Dr. King died for you to be free. And I tell you this, he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family and embarrassing your community. No, he did not. That was not his dream." And so then he wrapped up and he said, "You know, I hope Mr. Foreman is right. I hope you turn it around. But right now, actions have consequences, and your consequence is Oak Hill." And he sent him there 6 months. And as that case wrapped up and I was walking back to see Brandon in the cell block, there were three other young African-American men in there with him. And then I went to see his parents out in the hallway and his grandmother, and they were crying. And I really started to think about the fact that the judge wasn't alone. I already knew Brandon wasn't alone, right? I knew those numbers, the racial disparities for Black men in the system and Black women too. But what I also realized was that the judge wasn't alone, because there were a lot of people who thought the way he did. The city council that had passed the laws that Brandon was sentenced under was a majority Black city council. And the police force was majority African-American, and the police chief was African-American. And I realized that there was a history that needed to be written, or a story that needed to be told, because I wasn't originally thinking it was a book. I originally thought maybe I'd write an article. But there was a story that needed to be told about this first generation of Black elected officials and prosecutors and police chiefs and probation officers that comes into office and power in the 1970s and the 1980s, right after the decline of formal Jim Crow, and the pressures that they were under, the challenges that they faced, and how in the end many of them ended up supporting some of the same policies that the nation was supporting. And I wanted to write it with empathy and compassion and nuance, and really try to understand the perspective of people with whom I disagreed. But that was the kind of history that I wanted to write.
You did an incredible job of doing that. Nuance. I mean, I think so often in our political discourse, nuance gets lost. But that is in fact, where the story is. One of the central points of your book is that the road to mass incarceration had many small stations along the way, that it was the accrual of many small actions, not just federal actions, but local as well. And that's why you really focus like a laser on what happened in Washington, D.C., the first majority Black city, I believe, certainly possibly the first city to have a Black mayor. Is that correct?
It wasn't the first, but it was one of the early ones. So you had Carl Stokes in Cleveland, and then you had Newark and you had Los Angeles. These are late 60s, early 70s, and then DC in the mid 70s. So it was in that first group.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Forman Jr. about his book, Locking Up Our Own. And so you had a city council that had a lot of black representatives. The head of the city council was actually white, but he'd been very active in the civil rights or working for civil rights, if not in the civil rights movement. And the first issue came around marijuana. I had no idea that back in the 70s at that time that marijuana there was a big legalization movement, a decriminalization movement, not legalization, a decriminalization movement for marijuana. And Washington, D.C. was one of the places where this was played out. Tell us what happened and how that set the stage for, you know, the first steps down that road to mass incarceration.
I also didn't know that there had been a movement and that a number of states had decriminalized by the mid-70s, and that the federal government, you know, Jimmy Carter was talking about it at the federal level. So D.C. joins in 1975 when this first African-American city council comes into office. It's the locally elected council after the D.C. Home Rule Act. So Congress gives a lot of its authority for governing D.C. over to the government, the local government, and 11 of 13 of the first city council members are African-American, and the first mayor is African-American. And the move for decriminalization in D.C. actually comes from Dave Clark. You mentioned him. He's one of the white two white members on that first city council, but he has a very civil rights-oriented background. He went to Howard Law School. He worked with Martin Luther King in the late 1960s, and he becomes a lawyer for poor people, and he runs for city council, and he wins. And he looks at the disparities in arrest rates for marijuana. 80% of the people arrested for marijuana were African American. The city was 70% black at the time. So it wasn't a huge disparity, but it was a disparity. And more than that, the arrest rates were going up. Every year there were, from the late 60s to the mid 70s, the Metropolitan Police Department was arresting more and more people for marijuana. So Clark introduces a bill to try to decriminalize marijuana following the national trend. And today, you know, as we look back, we now know the damage that marijuana criminalization has done to all Americans, but especially and particularly to African Americans. And so you would think back in 75, this majority black council with this opportunity to do something different, even before the war on drugs really took hold, might have done that. But they didn't. And the reasons that they didn't, I think, are the most fascinating part of the story. So the opposition to decriminalization was led by a group of black ministers, and it was also led by a black nationalist minister on the city council, a guy by the name of Doug Moore. And their opposition to decriminalization wasn't because they didn't care about black communities or they didn't care about black youth. It was just the opposite. They cared very much, and they thought, well, we live in a racist society, and our black children have to be 2 and 3 times as good to survive. They can't afford to get high. Our children cannot afford either to be high in school or to be high at home or to be caught with marijuana on them. Because if any of those things happen, or if they become an addict, we don't have the resources in our community to protect them. We don't have the kind of money to put people into long-term drug treatment programs. We don't have that cushion. So the opposition comes from Doug Moore, black nationalist city council member who's a minister, and a group of African-American ministers. And the basis for their opposition is they care tremendously about the city's black youth, and they think that in a racist America, black people don't have the same margin for error. And that means that black children cannot afford to get high, to get caught with marijuana, because their schools are underfunded, because they have limited opportunities, because black families don't have money for drug treatment programs, black kids have to be twice as good, twice as clean, twice as pure. And so they say, we can't afford to have our children getting high. And so, no, we're not going to vote to decriminalize marijuana, because that's going to send a message to them that this kind of behavior could be encouraged. And they're doing all of this, it's important to remember, at the tail end of the heroin epidemic. So heroin ravaged black communities in the 1960s. The homicide rate in D.C. doubled, and some of that was attributable to heroin. In the early 1960s, 3% of the people entering D.C. jail tested positive for heroin. By 1969, it was 45%. And that was replicated in cities around America. And this fear that marijuana would be a gateway drug to heroin was very prevalent in the black community. The baseball great Jackie Robinson, his son was a heroin addict. And Jackie Robinson was going around to black churches and community centers in the early 1970s and saying, listen, my son became an addict and he started with marijuana. So do not vote to decriminalize.
This is so interesting because you're looking at this from the stance of the black community that was fiercely, that in fact saw the fight against drugs as part of the civil rights movement. On the other hand, you also had a white power structure that was using the war on drugs to destroy, many people think, to in fact destroy dissent in the black community. In fact, some people think that the white power structure brought in drugs into the black community and then use that as a pretext to go in and incarcerate. I mean, that's a simplified view of it, but you know, I think that there's been a lot of evidence that some of that was actually done deliberately. So my question is this, was that ever talked about, that it's almost as if black leaders are in a between a rock and a hard place? They're either collaborating with a racist white power structure against their own people, or they must have felt that they would be allowing the weakening of their own people, as you just spoke. I'm not sure I expressed that correctly, but do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And the fact is that a lot of the folks that I'm writing about in my book understood and shared that view that a racist America was making drugs more available in black communities. They didn't contest that. But their point was, and this is strongly held view by a number of black nationalists, right, in the 1960s and 1970s especially, they say things like, the mafia, a white power structure, is trying to dump drugs into our community. The question for us as black people is, are we going to be complicit in that, or are we going to resist? So one of the groups that I write about, a guy named Hassan Jeru Ahmed in the 1960s led something called the Black Men's Liberation Army, which was led principally by guys who had been incarcerated, many of them former addicts. And they were opposed to methadone treatment for heroin because they believed methadone was just substituting one more drug for another drug, heroin. Their view was that black people had to get off drugs entirely. And they knew, they said, one of the flyers that I have in the book, they say, listen, the white-faced dog mafia is selling illegal heroin and other dope to our school children. The only people who can stop this is us. But here's their other point. They said that black street dealers are the ones that are actually doing the distribution. They're the ones on the ground. They said, look, the government's not actually standing on the street corner. The mafia is not standing on the street corner. It's their black agents who are doing that. And they were very harsh and very vitriolic towards those black agents who they viewed as doing the white man's work of killing the black community. So what you're proposing as kind of and not an either or, but like two different ways of thinking about the issue, they embraced both and they didn't see a contradiction. Mm. right? They didn't see a contradiction between understanding that racist America wanted black people on drugs and themselves being very harsh towards black drug dealers and drug users. They didn't see those as intention.
But my question was the other part of that, which is that they would have to collaborate essentially with the white power structure in the incarceration of those drug dealers. I mean, those drug dealers were going into prisons for very long periods of time. Those prisons were run by the white-dominated ruling class. Did they ever stop to think about that part of the equation?
So that's a really good point, and thank you for clarifying that question. So I think this is where you start to see some of the changes over time. So the critique that you just elaborated is something that's much more visible today than it was in the early 1970s, right? That we started talking about heroin and marijuana decriminalization in the mid-1970s, right? Mass incarceration hadn't close to become a thing by then. People were aware that there was a racist prison system, right? That was known even in 1972, 1973. But it wasn't as much a part of the public consciousness to think of that as equal in threat to the black community as a threat of drug addiction and the crime that was associated with drug addiction. The view that the prison system is the biggest threat to black progress is something that develops over time. It develops over the 80s, 90s. It comes into full force in the last, 5 years or 10 years, I would say. But it wasn't as clear. So someone like Hassan Jeru Ahmed, he didn't want to turn to the government first, right? He still had that self-help. We're going to police our communities. The flyers that they would put into black neighborhoods said, if you find somebody who's selling drugs, you call our hotline. You tell us. We will deal with them. We will give them a warning. But then the flyers also said, if they don't listen, we will call the police. And in fact, in a sort of a little known court pleading that I was able to get my hands on, the U.S. prosecutors in D.C. cited Hassan Jeru Ahmed as what they called a gutsy collaborator. So he was turning over people when he couldn't get them to stop selling.
Now, another aspect of this whole road down to mass incarceration was the role of the black police. This was another civil rights struggle just to get black police on the forces. And again, you look at Washington, D.C., James Forman, in this book, Locking Up Our Own. Tell us about what people thought would happen once there were more black police on the force, and then what did happen and why.
Chapter 3 of the book is about the rise of black police in America from a time when it was unheard of to even imagine that there would be a black officer, that a black person would have a gun or have the authority to arrest, was something that you would have been laughed at for suggesting in 1900, 1910, 1920. To a point where, D.C. had its first black police chief by the late 1970s. By 1990, there were 130 cities in America that had black police chiefs, including, not just D.C., but also New York and Los Angeles and a number of America's big cities. And so that history, and as your question suggests, kind of what happened and what didn't happen, I find the most fascinating and surprising part of the book for me in my research. So one of the things that I hadn't realized was how long African American civil rights activists had been arguing for more black police as a part of the civil rights struggle. So Martin Luther King Sr., the father of the great civil rights leader in Atlanta at Morehouse College, when his son is a student at Morehouse, gives a speech where he asks the city of Atlanta to hire a single black officer, a Negro officer, to use the language of the day. And that was part of a campaign in the 1940s among Atlanta's black elite and some progressive whites to get Negro officers hired. The slogan that there's a picture of a protester in the book walking outside the Georgia Capitol, and his slogan says, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. The theory that they had was that these officers would pay more attention to crime in Black communities, and therefore they would help to reduce crime. Because you have to remember at the time, right, it's almost hard for us to remember this, but one of the great tragedies of American history is that for a long time, white officers and white police departments paid absolutely no attention to crime in Black communities. If there was a Black person committed a crime against a white person, that got heavy and harsh attention. But crime in a Black community with a Black victim was ignored. And so they thought, well, Black police officers won't do that, right? They'll come and they'll pay attention. And also they said, those officers will be able to distinguish those of us who are upstanding citizens from the more disreputable members of the community. And white officers can't tell any difference from, you know, between us. So these were the arguments that they were making in the 40s. Then by the 60s, of course, you have the riots and urban rebellions and throughout American cities, and there's more attention to police brutality. And then a lot of the arguments that you hear are that Black officers will be less brutal towards other Black citizens. But for me, the most fascinating part of all of this is that throughout this 40-year history, as people are arguing to hire more Black police officers, nobody's actually asking the people that are taking the jobs as police officers, right? The Black people that are taking the jobs as officers and joining the force and rising up through the ranks and facing incredible oppression and racism as they do. Bertell Jefferson, who becomes the DC chief, he joins the force in the 1940s, and he joins the force at a time when Black people cannot ride in a squad car, Black people cannot carry a gun, and Black people do not have the authority to arrest white citizens. And it was routine for the white officers to call the few Black officers on the force boy and worse, that I won't repeat on the air. So now these officers finally come through these ranks, and some of them become higher up. Some of them become, like Jefferson, become the chief. And we had this expectation that they would change policing, but nobody had asked them what their views were. And what my research finds is that most people that became police officers overwhelmingly did so because they wanted a good job, right? This is a deindustrializing America. Jobs are being ripped out of inner cities and out of America generally. Jobs are scarce. And municipal police jobs, these are good jobs to have. They're not going into the job as civil rights warriors. They're not going in the job as civil rights activists. Some of them have those concerns and those commitments, but it's very hard for them to act on those in a power structure that gives them very little room to operate. So the end result of all of this, I think, is that we do get significant Black representation on the police force in many cities. Not enough. We still need more, but we get significant. But the nature of policing doesn't change because the structure of the job doesn't change. The training doesn't change. The supervision doesn't change. The mission doesn't change. What changes is the complexion of the officers, and changing that isn't enough. So I remain today, when I have conversations today about police reform with my colleagues that are working on these issues, my line is very straightforward. I think we need to hire more Black officers and more Latino officers and more women officers. Right? My book's not about those others, but I believe that. But the reason we need more Black officers is because Black people deserve their fair share of good jobs in America, right? But it's not because they're going to change how we police in this country. To change that, we're going to have to change other aspects of the job.
James Forman Jr. We'll talk more about his book, Locking Up Our Own, after the break.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on. Be child now, brother. Give your hands to struggle. Give your hands to struggle.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking this hour with James Forman Jr. about his book, Locking Up Our Own. It's a groundbreaking look at how Black civil rights leaders and other leaders in the Black community contributed to the phenomenon of mass incarceration out of the best of intentions, a fierce desire to protect their communities and the young people in them from the scourge of drugs and crime. The establishment of mandatory minimum sentencing is now widely seen as a major factor in the growth of mass incarceration, and it was also something that Black leaders promoted. I had always thought mandatory minimums as applied to drug convictions was a creation of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, but not entirely. I asked James Forman Jr. to talk about the history and impact of mandatory minimums, and also to tell us a pertinent story about it from his book.
I should say, you know, you said you've always thought that it came from Nelson Rockefeller. And one thing that I think is really important to be clear of in discussing, you know, this book and this topic, is that it did in part come from Nelson Rockefeller, right? You know, nobody should cite this book and say there were no racist reasons to support mass incarceration, and there were no racist politicians who exploited fears to, you know, gin up support for tough on crime legislation. That's not what my book is about. Nelson Rockefeller did contribute to mandatory minimums, and Richard Nixon contributed to the war on drugs, and Ronald Reagan contributed to the war on drugs, and H.W. Bush and his Willie Horton ad helped to, you know, used a racist ad and racist imagery to get elected. And Bill Clinton deserves his share of the blame, right? And their analogies and at the state and local level too. So my book is not in any way suggesting that racism isn't absolutely essential for understanding the sweep of American history and in particular the development of mass incarceration and our carceral state. It is. My only point is that it's not the whole story, and I want to tell another part of that story, and that's what I try to do in that book. But I view myself as very much building on the work of Bryan Stevenson in Just Mercy and Ta-Nehisi Coates in Between the World and Me and Michelle Alexander in The New Jim Crow and the many other scholars, Heather Ann Thompson and Elizabeth Hinton and other people and Donna Murch that have written really powerful work documenting the role that race has played in producing the system that we live with today. But to turn to the Black community, a portion of that, and the DC portion of that in particular, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, again, with crime still very high, having risen dramatically in the 60s and not having declined since, and fear of crime very present in Black neighborhoods, and addiction with inadequate treatment programs and otherwise still very much a reality of life. In DC, a Black city council member by the name of John Ray and Bertell Jefferson, the first Black police chief who had now stepped down from that position and retired, these two men led a move to toughen the drug laws in the city, both to increase the maximums, right? We talk about mandatory minimums, and that's important, but that's not the whole story, right? The other story is, well, what's the maximum you can get? And so they led an effort first at the city council and then went directly to the voters. And when they were all done, they had achieved both. They had increased the maximum so that when they were finished, you could get 15 years in prison for selling any amount of a hard drug, heroin or cocaine. That was the maximum you could get. And there were mandatory minimums depended on the amount, but 2, 3, 4 years mandatory minimums depending on the specific amount. And what I find so troubling about that is not their intention, because their intention was to respond to a drug crisis, a violence crisis, and an addiction crisis. My frustration and my concern is with how they went about it. And there, the story of my client, Tasha Willis, really comes to the fore, because she had worked in the post office, had injured herself lifting box too heavy for her to lift, had started taking prescription pain medications, had eventually become addicted to those, and then had become addicted to heroin. So now she's a heroin addict, and this is the 1990s. And she gets arrested once for selling just a street sale, you know, hand-to-hand, little small $10, $15 packet of heroin, which is common for addicts to do the work, right, for sellers as they agree, okay, I'll sell these 10 packets for you, and then you'll give me some heroin at the end of the day. And so she did that. And she got arrested, and then she got arrested again. And now it was her third arrest that I was representing her on. And she wanted help. As soon as I met her, she said, you know, I want help. I want to go into a treatment program. The problem is there were virtually no treatment programs. At the time in the 1980s, the city had 1/10 of the treatment programs that it needed for all of its addicts. And that was typical. That's a typical number nationally. That was the number in the 1990s. And when I did my research, I found out that was, you know, some cities have 1/10 what they need. Some cities have 1/20. One cities have 1/5. Nobody has close to all the beds that they need. And when I met with the prosecutor to talk to her about this request, she wasn't an unreasonable prosecutor. I had worked with her before on a case. And she grabbed the file and she flipped it open. And as soon as she opened the file and looked at the second page, her face kind of fell and her mouth kind of hardened. And she started to shake her head and she said, no, 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 this, my office will never let me agree to a dismissal on a treatment program in this case or probation. And I said, why not? And she said, well, your client has had two previous opportunities in treatment. And neither one has worked. Both times she's dropped out or she's gone back to using. And now all the research shows, and anybody that's had a family member who's addicted or has been addicted themselves knows that it can often take. Sometimes it works the first time you enter a program, but often there's relapse. It takes 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 times before people are able to kick what's an incredibly powerful addiction. Heroin. And so I was so frustrated with this prosecutor and I started to really lose it, which isn't a good thing because it's never helpful as a public defender. You can't lose your cool when you're talking to prosecutors. It doesn't help your client. But I just couldn't control it. And I said to her at one point, you know, how come we never have the same standard for prison? How come we never say, oh, well, we're not going to try prison again. It didn't work last time. There's always a chance to try more prison. And another thing that I didn't say at the time, but I think about a lot, is the fact that we never say we don't have room in prison, right? We never say, well, you know, we would like to do this, but there's no beds. And we say that all the time with treatment programs. And so my great frustration with what John Ray and Bertel Jefferson did is not that they didn't care. They cared. It's not that they didn't want to help. They wanted to help. But they were locked into a mentality that said, the way we respond to drugs is through the criminal justice system, not as a public health matter. And as long as we are committed to that mentality, we will never solve the problem. We will always create more harm. And we always will leave people like Mrs. Willis without options.
James Foreman Jr., I'd like to ask you to comment on stop and frisk and the broken windows policy. Now, stop and frisk, you know, it's interesting. In New York City under Bloomberg had stop and frisk. When Mayor de Blasio came in, he stopped stop and frisk, but he didn't stop broken windows. And frankly, I don't really see much difference between them. So I wonder if you could comment on the broken windows policy and put it within the context of the purview of your book.
Sure. So, you know, frisk and broken windows are, as you say, they're different, but they're related. I mean, the basic idea behind broken windows is that when you leave kind of low level, even quality of life kinds of offenses, right? Broken windows started with a study that was done out at Stanford where they left a car with broken windows. And the idea behind it is that if you don't attend to that, if you don't repair that broken window, then that's going to send a message to people in the community that the government doesn't care and that nobody cares about this broken window. and that is going to, over time, lead fewer people to care. And then the people that do care and are bothered by that kind of disorder and want to live in a more orderly community, they'll leave. And then the only people that are going to be left are the people that don't care very much. And it's going to just be a spiral downward. And it's going to ultimately lead to increasingly serious crimes, so that you have to attend to the very, very low level things as a way of ensuring that things don't get worse. That's really, in a lot of ways, different from stop and frisk, in that although they can be used together, but they're conceptually different. I mean, the stop and frisk is simply a police tactic where they stop somebody on relatively low-level suspicion, and a reasonable, articulable suspicion is what the law requires, although these are often done without the legally required amount of suspicion. And then the officer engages in questioning. And then if they can cite to sufficient basis, and again, whether they really have it or not is something that's often contested, but if they can cite to basis, then they frisk the person. The theory behind these is typically that they want to search for weapons. And that was the theory that was used in New York. And what I write about in DC was the car version of that. So the car version of stop and frisk is what we call pretext stops or investigatory stops. These are stops where the police use any legal basis they can, from tinted windows to broken tail light to an expired inspection sticker to driving too fast, driving too slow, stopping at a stop sign for too long, stopping at a stop sign for not long enough, anything that they can find. After they've identified the car that they want to investigate, they use that as a pretext. That's why they're called pretexts. They don't actually care that you had the tinted windows or that you stopped at the stop sign for too long. They're interested in your car for other reasons, because they've developed a suspicion, often related to race and age of the people driving. What they really want to do is search your car. So they pull you over. They look at the car, which they're entitled to do as they're approaching it. And if they haven't developed any basis at that point, they ask for consent. And what the police know is that if they do it right, over 90% of the people who are asked for consent give it. Then they search the car. That's the whole reason they were doing this to begin with. And in my case, the case that I write about, I represented a woman named Sandra Dozier, who was in the car with her daughter. And she was pulled over on one of these pretext stops. She was asked about guns. She said she didn't have any guns. They asked if they could search. She agreed. They found $15, $20 worth of marijuana in her glove compartment. She's now incredibly frustrated and on the verge of tears, because she's got a job at FedEx and she doesn't want to get locked up over this weed. And she points to her uniform in the back seat and says, please, please, I have to go to work tomorrow. Don't lock me up. The officers are actually fairly reasonable. They give her a citation, a notice to return to court. She goes back to court in about a week and the case is dismissed. It's no paper. So in a way, the criminal justice system would think of itself as operating fairly leniently here. But because she's a probationary employee on a new job, she has to get a certificate of clean record before she can be hired permanently. And when she goes for the certificate, it returns that she had this arrest for marijuana, and she's summarily fired. And she reaches out to me, desperate for somebody to try to help her. She's now lost a job that she spent a year and a half waiting in lines at job fairs to get. And I call her supervisor, and he is very understanding, but he says, there's nothing I can do. It's a company policy. It's above my pay grade. And so one of the reasons why I use her story, and she never gets her job back, and it's an absolute tragedy and leaves me in tears when it happened. And one of the reasons I tell the story is that, to me, it shows the down-the-line consequences of policies that maybe could be justified, or I could understand where people would be coming from. Because the reason why the city was doing these kind of stops was because of concern about gun violence. And Eric Holder, the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, had come up with this policy of pretext stops. He called it Operation Ceasefire, and he was doing it because D.C. was at the tail end of the crack years and was suffering previously unheard of levels of homicide and shooting. And so he wanted to do something. He wanted to get guns. He unleashes Operation Ceasefire to do it. And because of how something like this plays out, it means that someone like Sandra Dozier, who's nowhere near any guns, who just has a drug in it, that across town, white people are driving. They're not being pulled over. They're not being stopped. If they were, they'd find weed. But it never happens to them. It happens to the Sandra Doziers of the world. And so to me, it shows how you can have in some ways reasonable intentions. I actually think Holder had reasonable intentions. But you produce a regime that just perpetuates these kinds of injustices.
Exactly. And yes, and thank you for pointing out the ways in which Stop and Frisk and broken windows are different. But I guess the thing I meant is that broken windows leads to the same kinds of results as Stop and Frisk. You know, I mean, Eric Garner died because of broken windows. I mean, he's selling loose cigarettes. What's the point? So really what it goes back to is the kind of warrior policing you talk about in your book, Locking Up Our Own, and also the whole larger context within which incarceration, the drug war, you know, is all played out. So now I guess I'd like to ask you, given this context, how do we unravel it so that the concerns of the Black community for being protected and the concerns that we all have about mass incarceration can be more successfully addressed?
That is the crucial question. And so I'm so glad you asked it. And because I do think there's maybe two big themes of my book that carry forward. One is embodied in your question, which is that we absolutely have to have solutions that in fact address the felt needs for safety of the communities that I'm writing about. And it's not enough to say we're going to do nothing. Number two big theme of my book is that this is a system that was built not in one fell swoop, not with one vote, right? We never as a nation had an up or down vote on whether we wanted to be the world's largest jailer, whether we wanted to have 5% of the population and 25% of the nation's prisoners, whether we wanted to lock up more people than Russia and South Africa under apartheid. That was never put to a vote. Instead, what happened is over a 40 or 50 year period and across 50 states and the federal government and DC and 3,000 counties, everybody in their various different domains, police, prosecutors, judges, legislators, probation officers, parole officers, private employers, people like the employer that wouldn't hire Sandra Dozier because of that arrest, right? Everybody got 10, 15, 20, 25% tougher. And if everybody does that over a 40 or 50 year period and across the country, then what you get is 2.2 million people in prison and 7 million people under criminal justice supervision. And we can't even count how many people have lost their right to vote because of convictions. So that's how the system was built, I believe, and I argue, and that's how we're going to have to unwind it. So if we take those two ideas together, right, that we're going to have to, we have to respond to the needs of the communities and that we're going to have to do this in a series of small but relentless steps. Some really specific ideas that I think are starting to gain traction and I think are very powerful are on the policing side. There's a program now out of Seattle called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And the basic idea of the program is that we make a mistake when we tell police all they have the power to do is to arrest. Because what happens is, and I see this in my book, you see example after example of this. Police officers get called by community members. You'll hear this, right? If you ask police officer, well, you know, racial disparity and racial profiling, and they'll always say, we get calls from those communities, right? And the evidence is strong. That's true. They do get a lot of calls from low-income communities. And I see that over and over again in my book, store owners, storekeepers, and residents saying, listen, there's low-level dealers. They're always standing out in front of my house or in front of my business. You've got to do something about them. Right now, what we do is we send police and we tell them that their only option is arrest. In Seattle, and it's now gone national, it exists in about 10 cities and they're considering it in about 50 more, is the police in collaboration with social service providers and the public defender's office, have come up with a model where the police officers have the ability to talk to somebody, either who they're arresting, or they're not even doing an arrest. They call it social contact, just somebody that they know standing on the corner. They can go up to that person and say, listen, I have a bed in a drug treatment program that provides mental health services and housing assistance. And the person is always suspicious, right? Because we normally give people phone numbers and we tell them, well, if you call this number, then, and they know there's a 2-year waiting list, like what happened with Tasha Willis. But in this case, the officer says, no. The bed's available now. I can take you there and you can enter this alternative treatment program this afternoon. Well, that's a whole different conversation, right? Because one of the things is that's true is a lot of times people want treatment, they want help, but we don't know that exact moment when they're ready for it. But when they're in that conversation with that officer on the street who's offering this as an option, people are taking it up. And the research that they've done out of the program shows that the people that enter the program are 58% less likely to be arrested than people that just either don't go into any program at all or go to the jail route. So to me, that's a really good example of how when somebody says, but we're getting phone calls, right? We are needed. We are wanted. We can now say to them, yeah, okay, you're wanted, but are you wanted for an arrest or can you be deployed for another purpose? So that's one example of something that I think is kind of tremendous. I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see tremendous growth of that program. So that's on the policing side. But what about on the prosecutor side? The prosecutors are the most single powerful actors in our criminal justice system, right? Everybody has power, but they have the most power. One thing that I think people haven't noticed, paid enough attention to because of the disaster of what happened last November at the federal level. But last November, for the first time in my career working on these issues, a whole series of progressive prosecutors, reform-oriented prosecutors, ran for office on campaigns of, we're locking up too many people, and the war on drugs has had devastating consequences for our community, and we need more treatment and more mental health and less incarceration. Those were their platforms, and they won. They won in Chicago, in Denver, in Texas, in Alabama, in Florida. Just last week in Philadelphia, a civil rights lawyer turned prosecutor. And that's not even a sentence that we used to, in the 80s and 90s and last decade, you couldn't say civil rights lawyer turned prosecutor, right? That wasn't even a sentence. Larry Krasner, opposed to holding people in prison in jail because they can't afford to pay their bail, he ran on that platform and many other reform platforms, and he won. Now, these prosecutors have much, much more power than we've understood. 88% of our prisoners in this country are in state, county, and local prisons. They're not in the federal prisons. So Jeff Sessions is, you know, he's terrible and he's a disaster. But this campaign to elect more reform-minded progressive folks at the state, county, and local level is, to me, incredibly heartening. So that's prosecutors. So I said police, prosecutors. But the third piece of this is courts and what happens when somebody actually has been arrested and has been charged. They haven't been diverted. And there, I think the most exciting thing, the thing that really kind of has me fired up as an alternative, is restorative justice programs. One of the things that mistakes that we've made is we have basically told victims of crime that they have a choice, prison or nothing. And if you tell people that are victimized by crime, the choice is prison or nothing, overwhelmingly people will choose prison. But research by the Alliance for Safety and Justice has shown that if you give people a different set of choices, if you say to them, well, you can have prison or the person who committed this crime can get access to drug treatment and job training, and they're going to apologize to you, and they're going to make restitution. How does that sound versus prison? By 2 and 3 to 1 margins, people, including people who are victims of serious crimes, especially in communities of color, say, oh, no, we want that other range of options, right? Because people know increasingly that prison doesn't work, but we have to give them something else. So what restorative justice does is it's a set of facilitated conversations where the victim takes the lead. And after preparation and agreement, the victim eventually sits down with the person who committed the crime, and the whole conversation starts with the victim's perspective. And the victim talks about, here's what happened to me, and here's what it felt like to me when you broke into my house, when you robbed me, right? When you beat me up, depending on the nature of the case. And here's how I was harmed. And here's how I've been damaged. And here's how I'm still hurting. And then the person who committed the crime talks about it from their perspective. They get to apologize. They get to feel that pain and absorb that pain and talk back to the person and share their remorse. They also get to share aspects of their background, things that the victim may not know, ways in which they themselves were abused as a child, ways in which they've struggled, and their commitment to change going forward. And then comes out of that, not a how long should the prison sentence be, but what are the things that we could do collectively, collaboratively? What are the things that we want the government to do to try to restore this harm? And in some cases where the people know each other, to restore this relationship. Those programs, there's an organization called Impact Justice that is doing amazing work promoting restorative justice around the country. Restorativejustice.org is a great resource for people that want to learn more. For the LEAD program that I mentioned before, LEADBureau.org has great resources. So I think we're at a moment now where people are willing to consider some of these other options, and where some of these other options have been kind of sufficiently developed and robust and built up. Because that's the thing for us that are on the more progressive side of this issue. Prison's easy. It's very straightforward to build a prison and to lock somebody up. You just need a budget line. But to do these alternatives requires thought, requires foresight, requires human capital, right? Requires real deep planning and changing the culture of institutions that have built up. Like the police in LEAD, they've only been trained so far to arrest. So you actually have to retrain officers in this different approach. So it's harder, but we've now, after 5-10 years, we've really started to build up some robust alternatives. And I'm optimistic about them in the coming few years. And this is the thing, I talked about small steps. None of these things by themselves is going to change mass incarceration, right? But all of them collectively, right? If we do all of these things collectively and relentlessly, we will start to see a real shift.
Well, that's terrific. And so is your book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. James Foreman, Jr., thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much.
James Foreman, Jr. teaches law at Yale University. Read an excerpt from Locking Up Our Own at writersvoice.net. You'll also find links to more information about mass incarceration in America. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.